From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Flashpoints. Today on Flashpoints, we talk with a former Marine combat pilot turned historian for his views about U.S. foreign policy. Then we discuss the obscured international press coverage of the so-called temporary peace agreement between Trump and Iran. Finally, we're joined by two peace activists who've been at it a long time to discuss their recent protests against the war machine. I'm Kevin Pina, and we'll be right back with that and more here on Flashpoints, your daily investigative news magazine. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, there's a carefully constructed mythology in the United States, one taught in schools, repeated endlessly by politicians, and reinforced every night in the corporate evening news. It's the myth of American benevolence. It tells us that when the U.S. drops bombs, stages coups, or imposes crippling economic sanctions, it's doing so to spread democracy, protect human rights, and maintain global stability. But what happens when the people executing those missions on the ground realize the story's a lie? Michael Lester is a Naval Academy graduate and a former Marine combat pilot who served across Asia and the Middle East, but after spending two decades observing the devastating reality of U.S. interventions firsthand, he realized the missions didn't match the rhetoric, and the people the U.S. claimed to be liberating didn't feel liberated at all. Today, he's a historian, a fierce critic of empire, and the author of the explosive new book, We Are the Bad Guys, The Global Cost of American Power, U.S. Imperialism, Foreign Policy, and Covert Wars. Michael, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hello, Kevin. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's start with your personal trajectory. The military-industrial complex invests heavily in ensuring that officers like you coming out of the Naval Academy do not question the fundamental morality of American power. As a Marine combat pilot flying missions across the Middle East and Asia, what were the specific ground-level contradictions you witnessed that finally broke through the propaganda and made you realize the U.S. wasn't the good guy in the story?
You know, it's a great question. It's something that I get asked fairly frequently. And there is no aha moment. This is one of those things that it kind of grows on you over a long period of time. You see something, you see another thing, you see a third thing, and you start saying, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. And now, at that point in time, you do one of two things. You either ignore it and you move on, or you start digging into it more. And I've got one of those brains that I can't ignore something. If something doesn't fit, I've got to go find out why it doesn't fit. When I was flying some missions, there were a couple of missions I flew in the first Gulf War where I was on the mission. I later saw a CNN report that reported something, and I'm like, that's not what we did. That's not right. How that happened, you know? And you look back and you're like, okay, so why? Why is it being reported one way? Why is it being reported with a certain narrative? And then as you start digging into that, you start realizing that there is a constructed narrative that everything needs to fit into to support, you know, to garner support for what the U.S. is doing sometimes. People have to believe, hey, we're doing this for all the right reasons. And sometimes that's just not true.
Well, it seems like, you know, the Trump administration has thrown that playbook out a bit, right? Now, I mean, we even hear people on the left saying, well, at least he's honest, right? He's no longer trying to hide what is naked American imperialism to steal others' resources behind the lies of democracy.
And you know what? And I kind of agree with that. At least it is more out in the open. That doesn't make it better. Coming out and saying, yeah, I killed the person doesn't make you not a murderer. It just means that you somehow are comfortable with it, which I think is maybe even worse. One of the things I think the most honest thing we did was, or the most honest thing that Trump maybe has done, is referred to the Department of Defense as the Department of War. We are not defending ourselves. No one is attacking us. We are projecting power across the globe. And it's, if you start looking at it, it's hard to argue that we're not. I mean, we spend more than the next 10 countries on our military. We have 700 bases around the world. How can you look at that as anything other than we are an empire trying to project power?
And let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of my guest, Michael Lester. He's a Naval Academy graduate and former Marine combat pilot who served across Asia and the Middle East. He has written an amazing new book called We Are the Bad Guys, The Global Cost of American Power, U.S. Imperialism, Foreign Policy, and Covert Wars. Well, the title of your book is uncompromising. I mean, for a lot of Americans who consider themselves patriotic, that title is deeply uncomfortable. And I think rightfully so. But your work is grounded in declassified documents and primary sources, tracking decades of covert operations and economic coercion. How do you explain to U.S. citizens that the chaos we see in the global South today is not an accident, but the predictable engineered result of a deliberate decades-long strategy of U.S. dominance?
Yeah, and that's difficult. The problem is people don't want to know a lot of times. People would like to remain inside their comfortable cocoon and not know. I actually talk to people. I talk to people every day, right? And a lot of them will just say, I don't care. I don't want to know. That always surprises me. But what we're doing around the world, what is happening in the global South, it is part of a larger system. And I go back a lot of times in the book and I say, to really understand where we're at and why we're doing this, you have to look back at the history a little bit. We have a tendency to pick out a point in time and use it as an excuse for doing something. You know, I'm going to pick one. October 7th was a big one in everybody's mind with Israel, right? Look, Hamas attacked on October 7th. They took 200 and I forgot the exact number, a little over 200 hostages. That was horrible. But then I have to go back and say, okay, well, on the 6th, October 6th, Israel held over 5,000 Palestinian hostages.
Right.
And people look at you and go, what? I'm like, yeah, you got to look back. Look at February 28th. You know, we attacked Iran, you know, and we claimed that, you know, we're doing that for our defense and because they have, you know, they're working on enriching fissionable material. But I said, you know, you've got to look back. You've got to remember that Iran had a democratically elected government that was not a theocracy. And we orchestrated a coup in 1953, you know, and put in the Shah. I mean, so all of this is pretty much our own making. And if you go back in time and you start looking at what we've done over the years, this pattern emerges. And it's hard to argue the pattern once you expose it and you start to examine it.
Well, how do you feel when you hear Secretary of War Pete Hegseth invoke God, right? We're hearing all these narratives. We're the good guys because God's on our side. And we're even hearing that it's reaching troops in the field. What's your perspective on that? I mean, I've never heard anything like that to this point, to this extent.
Yeah, it's, you know, every single force in history has invoked God and said God is on their side. The Nazis said God was on their side. Everybody has said that. You can't say God is against us. You have to say God is on our side. I believe in being more secular. I don't think religion should have a place in our military. I don't think we should be doing things for religious reasons. Now, we can say that we have a separation of church and state. We really don't. I mean, our money says in God we trust. We take, you know, oaths on the Bible. And that's okay to a degree. But we've got to be careful when we start crossing that line into justifying military action and killing.
That we don't become the theocracy. That we don't become a theocracy ourselves.
Exactly. Using the same reasoning that a theocracy would use.
Well, one of the core themes you write about is perception and information control. When you were in the military, you saw one reality, and then when you watched the news back home, you saw another, of course, as you said earlier. But right now, the corporate media is dutifully repeating the Pentagon's talking points, even the New York Times, you know, which will push back domestically, but then we see almost parrot exactly some of the illogical rationales of this administration, word for word. From your perspective inside the machine, how exactly is the media apparatus weaponized to ensure that the public here never understands the true cost of these imperial wars?
A great question. And this goes back to, you've got to have the people on your side in one way or the other. And to do that, you've got to construct a narrative, and you've got to keep repeating that narrative. And that narrative has to be unfaltering. Otherwise, people start to ask questions, right? And I don't think a lot of Americans know that the U.S., we love the fact that we have freedom of speech. We love that we have the freedom of the press. Internationally, we rank 57th in freedom of speech and freedom of the press. We do not have free speech and do not have free expression. And our journalists don't. You see this when you see one of the first things Trump did was stopped having any journal briefings. Those were curtailed. He then said, I'm going to pull the credentials of everybody at the Pentagon unless you say what we want you to say. I mean, this is just blatant information control. And those are just two quick examples. There are so many that you can go into showing where the current administration has curtailed access and curtailed funding and has attacked any journalist that does not cover the news exactly the way they want to. That creates a curated narrative. And that's important if you want to keep doing something that the populace might not agree with overall.
Well, and it's certainly nothing new, right? I mean, there's a long history of obfuscation, you know, including the Central Intelligence Agency. I was just talking about this with a previous guest, planting journalists, right?
Absolutely.
Overtly,
yeah.
Right? In order to present a picture that is supportive of a particular U.S. foreign policy while identifying an enemy and demonizing them and sort of softening the ground for the next attack. Well, Michael, I'm also wondering, what is your perspective of this current Trump regime? What is your feeling? Now, I know you have kind of focused on war and imperialism and U.S. foreign policy, but I know it has to be, you know, I've read your stuff in your most recent article, and I know that this stuff is keeping you up at night a little bit, right? That
it
you have
does.
You got some views about this. Tell us, what are
it
your views
does.
About this current regime?
Yeah, you know what? I have to say, I think I'm pretty clear with most people. I don't agree with most of what Trump does, says, or how he approaches things. I think that's okay. I think the mark of a true patriot is holding your government accountable. If you don't disagree with your government and you agree with everything they say, then you're not being a good patriot. A good patriot, it's kind of like a parent, right? If you give your kid everything they want, the kid just turns out spoiled. You have to not give them everything, ask why they're doing, and hold them accountable for their actions. We need to do that with our government. I see President Trump more as a symptom of what has been kind of building for years, more than just the saying that he is the nexus of it, right? I think the biggest problem we have right now is not necessarily the president, but our Congress. I think our Congress has abdicated most of their power and refuses to hold the president in the checks and balances that our founding fathers put in place. If they did that, we wouldn't be in the place we are today. But even recently with the Iran war, you know, the president, sure, he went in and said, you know, I'm going to put troops here, I'm going to attack. Congress has to then invoke the War Powers Act, which they have 8 times, and they've been voted down all 8 times. They're abdicating their responsibility to perform the checks and balances that keep this government safe and sane. I think that's the biggest problem. Again, I see Trump more as a symptom than an actual cause.
Well, it's interesting because I share, I think, a lot of the same historical and frames of reference as you. As a contemporary. And what was frightening to me was, you know, first there's this demonization of foreigners abroad, but also at home, right?
Yes.
The folks are supposed to be afraid of who are gonna commit acts of crimes against our citizens at home. And then we saw ICE killing their allies in the streets of Minnesota. I mean, that was pretty unprecedented to see a paramilitary force on the streets of the United States actually shoot and kill protesters. And then just, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I heard Vice President J.D. Vance say, we also have to be concerned about the left in this country. We've got to be concerned with our internal enemies who simply don't want us to win. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, you know, what that tells me is you feel like anybody that says that, they have a mandate from maybe God, that they have to win, they're right, and everyone else is wrong. And regardless of anyone else's opinions, it doesn't care. They don't care because they just feel they're in the right. I think that is the antithesis of what a true republic should be. And the reason we have a democratically elected republic is so that we, the people, decide what we should be doing. Yes, we are a republic. We elect people that then make the laws and take care of things. But that doesn't mean those people that we elected then become our masters. They're still public servants that are supposed to be doing what we, the people, want. I think that is a huge breakdown when I hear something like that.
Well, you recently wrote a piece arguing that the geopolitical anxiety we're feeling right now is completely misdiagnosed by the mainstream media. Everyone's looking for the next Hitler to justify military action, but you argue that we're actually repeating the blundering structural arrogance that led to the First World War. As we watched Washington blindly escalate a massive bombing campaign against Iran, how's the empire's structural blindness and refusal to see the world from any perspective other than its own dragging us straight into a global, potentially nuclear conflict?
Yeah. And this was when I was asked the question, do I think what we're seeing right now is like 1939, right? The beginning of World War II. And I said, no, it's not. I see it more as the beginning of World War I around 1913. And the reason is in 1939, we had a clear, definable action, person, instance that we had to respond to. And by trying to say this is like 1939, it incorrectly frames it in a kind of frame that if you don't see this, it's so clear, then you're morally inept, right?
Right.
But in 1913, what we had was a number of treaties and agreements with people, not just us, everybody. They had so many agreements that if you get attacked, I'll jump in. If this person gets attacked, that person will jump in. It was kind of like setting up dominoes. Once one fell, they all had to fall. And we're kind of seeing that. I actually made this analysis before February 28th. And we're seeing that now where we attack Iran. Well, we in Israel attack Iran. Iran didn't come back and attack just the United States per se, and Israel. They attacked Israel. But the United States, again, has 700 bases. We had bases all over. So Iran.
Including ringing Iran in the other Gulf states, right?
Yes. Yes. And that's it. Those bases are in Bahrain and UAE and Saudi Arabia. Iran bombed those. They're U.S. bases that are being used to attack Iran. So Iran said, okay, I'm gonna attack those, right? And the countries they're in are not happy that the U.S. and Israel started a war, and they're the ones getting attacked. What was even more telling was Iran launched a massive barrage, and I forgot what day it's on, but aiming missiles at most of these other bases and Israel. And it was so overwhelming, we couldn't shoot down all the missiles. So our systems had to make a choice. Which ones do we shoot down? We effectively ignored the missiles going to all of the other countries and shot down or tried to shoot down most of the missiles going to Israel. Well, the other country saw this and said, wait a minute. So when push comes to shove, you said, if we let you have a base here, we would get support and protection.
Right.
But when this happened, you didn't support or protect us. You supported and protected somebody else. This kind of revealed what is happening with our government. And I think this is going to have serious repercussions for U.S. involvement and influence in the Middle East for decades to come.
Well, and I couldn't quite understand the reaction of those Gulf states. They said, well, why are you shooting at us? As if those U.S. military bases didn't exist.
Right. And that's where we're launching planes from. I mean, and we have radar units there. Well, that's what's being used against, if I was an Iranian, I'd be, that's what's being used against us. So that's what I have to attack to stop being attacked myself.
Well, fascinating. We're going to do this again. Michael Lester, we didn't have enough time. I wanted more time with you. We're going to do this again. I hope you're going to return to Flashpoint soon.
I would love to. Thank you.
Again, that's Michael Lester. He's the author of the book, We Are the Bad Guys, The Global Cost of American Empire, U.S. Imperialism, Foreign Policy, and Covert Wars. Michael Lester, thanks so much for being our guest today here on Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
Power is here against hunger and greed and racist bloodshed on which fascists feed. Into battles for homes and hell, soften up enemies to liberate our wealth.
Take two, the streets in protest.
And welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. As the U.S. military apparatus continues to plunge the Middle East into chaos, the corporate press is working overtime to sell these aggressive escalations as strategic victories. But outside the Washington media bubble, the reality is starkly different. The so-called rules-based international order is rapidly disappearing, and the Global South is actively organizing against U.S. interference and control. Joining us for a critical follow-up interview to help us decode the shifting geopolitical landscape is Wyatt Reed. He's a frontline international journalist and editor with The Gray Zone. And Wyatt reported directly from the crosshairs of the American empire, from the trenches of Donbass to the streets of Caracas in the Middle East. He's back with us today to cut through the State Department propaganda and look at how the multipolar world is actually responding to this latest wave of imperial aggression. Wyatt, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, always a pleasure to have you as well. This desperation of the declining empire theme, Wyatt. I can't help but believe that the more that Trump attempts to project and assert U.S. power and might throughout the world, that in fact, it representing a strength, it actually is symbolic of weakness and an empire desperately clinging to what it already has.
That's certainly true, and it's not just what they have; it's what they don't. And that's today. It's the Strait of Hormuz. We've seen a lot of talk and some reactions to this supposed ceasefire that was announced last night by Donald Trump, confirmed shortly thereafter by the Iranian side. Seems to already be disintegrating. We've just seen statements from the Iranian Speaker of the Parliament saying that this ceasefire is basically over before it's even started, due to what they describe as violations of three of the 10-point plan, three points of the 10-point plan that they announced last week and that Trump accepted last night in his Truth Social media post as the basis of negotiations. Now all of that's being walked back after a rather hostile intervention from kind of Israel and its various media proxies in the United States, people like Laura Loomer, very antagonistic to the concept of peace in general, but certainly as it relates to Israel, to Iran, and to Lebanon in particular, where we have seen some of the deadliest bombing in months,
continuing still
as kind of a reaction, as I think a demonstration of the Israeli attitude towards this supposed ceasefire. So you know what happens, what's happening is I think what a lot of us predicted. Trump wants to talk the peace talk, but he can't walk the walk. And it seems to be because he's tied to the hip to this Zionist lobby, to the Israel industry. It's, you know, by far his biggest donors. And he knows how his bread is buttered. He clearly is not going to do anything to disturb that relationship. So if he's unwilling to rein in Israel, then, you know, I'm not sure how this ceasefire is going to pan out. If, on the other hand, he's content to allow Iran to wage war against Israel and vice versa and sit out and not participate, well, then I think that's actually probably kind of a win from the Iranian perspective, as long as the U.S. and its kind of Gulf state supposed allies, I would describe them more as vassals, but these countries, as long as they're willing to sit on the sideline and they're not going to intervene and not going to try to shoot out Iranian drones from their skies as they're passing over to Israel, you know, I think that's probably something that the Iranians are pretty much okay with.
Well, and this is Flashpoints. That's the voice of my guest, Wyatt Reed. One thing that seems to be a constant is disinformation. And certainly compromising the integrity of the press seems to be a large part of that when it comes to U.S. intelligence. You just released this massive expose about a reporter who works with the BBC senior Persian reporter, Gonchin Habibiyazad, I believe is how you pronounce it, Habibiyazad, and how she's a dedicated regime change activist in Iran, and her career was really launched by U.S. government propaganda networks like Radio Farda. She now openly admits that she only communicates with anti-government opposition figures. How does your investigation illustrate the systematic way that Western state broadcasters act as a laundering service for imperial intelligence?
Well, it's a great question, and I think this case really illustrates it almost perfectly. This woman, Gonche Habibiyazad, is a 27-year-old who's been appointed a senior reporter at the BBC after just a handful of years, 4 years in journalism. And just for reference, other BBC job listings for senior reporters demand at a minimum 8 to 10 years of experience in the field of journalism. She has half of that, if that. So she came to my attention and the attention of much of the internet a couple days ago when she published a quote on BBC that she attributed to an anonymous 20-something-year-old alleged Iranian young man who demanded that the United States drop a nuclear weapon on his country, who suggested that this would this was something good and necessary that to be done. The exact quote was that he was okay with using an atomic bomb or leveling Iran. Just a really horrifying thing to say. And social media users reacted, I think, predictably to this quote, horrified by it, and began asking this woman, Gonche Habibiyazad, is this quote real? Why would you publish this? Why would you want to encourage a nuclear strike on what you say is your own country, the country you grew up in? And she responded by blocking people all over social media in violation of BBC policy, which states that that blocking people is on social media is a method of last resort that should be used only in cases of personal harassment and not to deflect from legitimate criticism, which obviously this is. So, you know, my alarm bells went off and a lot of others did as well. And people began looking into exactly who this woman was, where did she come from? And I found that after she graduated from a very prestigious university in Iran, Tehran University, which as an Iranian citizen would have been paid for entirely by Iranian taxpayers, within a year of receiving this excellent education, as many Iranian women do, decided to move to the West and got an internship with a subsidiary of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is a CIA-founded propaganda front created in 1949 by Alan Dulles, and you know, which ostensibly separated from the agency in the 70s, but has never separated from the mission of trying to subvert the U.S. official enemies list. You know, it started off with the Soviet Union, but it quickly encompassed countries like China, and you know, countries like Iran. We have a long time kind of propaganda network in place to delegitimize that government, to prop up opposition activists and monarchists. And this is where this woman got her start, was at Radio Farda, which is an RFE, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty subsidiary. This is where she began to work as a journalist. And simultaneously, she worked handling social media for an Iranian opposition TV network called Marjan TV. And in these roles, and I should just say this outlet, Marjan TV, and its Manoto TV, which is another channel it's affiliated with that works underneath it, they're basically obsessed with the Pahlavi dynasty. If you go onto their YouTube channel and you try to look up their videos, every other video has the face of Reza Pahlavi, this would-be king of Iran who presents himself as the future ruler, you know, from this monarchical dynasty that was kicked out of power in Iran and then reimposed in 1953 when the, or after 1953 when the U.S. and the U.K., plotted to overthrow the first democratically elected leader of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, in 1953. They reimposed the Shahs, and they seek to do so today through these same sort of through the son, right, through Reza Pahlavi, the next ostensible Shah. So we are stuck in Pahlavi land again. And my question with this reporter was, okay, so how does she, this random 27-year-old woman, or I guess at the time she was 20, 23, how does she become a journalist? And then how does she immediately rocket to prominence to become this, you know, senior BBC reporter, a position that at one point in time was considered very prestigious, right? Had, as far as we're aware, never even been to Iran, but she was promoted as this kind of mascot for the protests, who's just out here cheerleading for them and replicating some of the most incendiary claims without really being able to verify them, as far as we can tell. An article that was written in 2022 that claimed that the Iranian security forces were somehow targeting women by shooting them in the genitals. And they came up with a quote to justify this from an alleged network of anti-government doctors who they supposedly are in contact with, who claimed that the Iranian security forces decided to, quote, shoot at the faces and private body parts of women because they have an inferiority complex and they want to get rid of their sexual complexes by hurting these young people. And they provided no evidence for the fact that, you know, that any of this had happened, no evidence that anyone had been targeted in their genitals, no photos, no, the only thing that they pointed to was this network of doctors who they said they'd been put in touch with. And I looked into this network of doctors. I went back and I listened to podcasts that these women did at the time describing it. And they pretty much openly described that they were just put in contact with people who they describe as doctors, who they claim are doctors, but who are very openly Pahlavists and opposition activists themselves. It's the same network of doctors, of alleged doctors, that was used to create this claim that 30,000 people had been killed by Iran in just 2 days by the Iranian security forces using small arms. Just a kind of a preposterous notion that somehow this government ran around and in the span of 48 hours was able to just mow down tens of thousands of people in the streets and then disappear all their bodies and disappear all the evidence. That's the claim that these people are running with. Now, of course, the official Iranian position is that something around 3,000 people died. Obviously horrifying. The violence was obviously horrifying. But in these people's, you know, these BBC and Guardian journalists' retellings, there's never any mention of the fact that Mike Pompeo and the Israeli Mossad and Israeli government itself have all openly acknowledged that Mossad was infiltrating these protests. Donald Trump himself yesterday stated openly that we shipped tons and tons of arms, or we attempted to send massive amounts of weapons to these protesters. So not exactly peaceful protests, as you know, a Trump base would probably tell you if you know they saw a BLM protest happening in their city. Imagine for a second that those protesters had been armed with firearms by a hostile foreign power, right? Imagine if BLM, you know what I mean? Like if China had somehow decided we're going to ship a bunch of AK-47s so that BLM activists can take over the city streets and impose, and go to war with the police, it would be interpreted as an act of war, right? And it was in Iran. And instead, here we have this narrative pushed by these people that these were innocent protesters. And in some cases, I'm sure a lot of them were, but they were caught up in the crossfire of a war that was being waged by Mossad and by Western intelligence agencies on Iran, and that many people still don't know was happening. We need legitimate news gathering sources. Until that moment, I think we're just going to get more of the same, more war propaganda slop getting shoveled down our throats.
Well, it certainly, there's a long, undistinguished history of the CIA infiltrating the press and planting operatives in order to destabilize governments. It wouldn't be the first time. And give us the title of that article and where we can find it.
Yeah, the headline is Senior BBC Iran Reporter Exposed as Opposition Activist. You can find that on thegrayzone.com. And that was my latest article. So you can also find that on my social media, on my Twitter at WyattReed13, and my Substack as well.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure. Again, that's the voice of our guest, Wyatt Reed. He is an editor with The Gray Zone. Great reporting, Wyatt. Can't thank you enough. We'll be back to you soon.
Thanks so much. Always a pleasure.
And you're still listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. It is now an honor to have my next guest, Kathy Boylan of the Dorothy Day Catholic Workers Organization. Kathy, welcome to Flashpoints.
It's wonderful to be with you, Kevin. Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about your history. I want people to know a little bit about your history, where you come from, how you got involved in the kind of organizing that you've been doing for decades now. Tell us a little bit of that background.
All right. Well, I was born in New York, in the Bronx in New York. And I guess skipping right ahead, well, one significant thing is that I had a baby brother a year younger than I, who developed leukemia in 1947 and died of leukemia 6 months later in 1948. And I guess that was a very important lesson for me, because my parents grieved for that, my brother, my entire childhood. We went to the cemetery every weekend. And I came to feel that, well, goodness, if one little boy's death caused so much suffering, why would human beings actually get in planes, bomb countries, burn people alive, caused total destruction? Why are we doing that? So that's been part of the formation of my understanding of what my life should be about, trying to prevent the suffering and death of other people and the world, of course. So I even have a date, May 17th, 1968. If you'll remember, that was the Catonsville Nine action in Baltimore. And nine people, mostly religious people, including Phil and Dan Berrigan, went to a draft board in Catonsville, removed the draft files of the young men who would serve, would be sent to war imminently. And they poured homemade napalm on those files and set them on fire. I was blessed to turn on the radio on May 17th in the afternoon, 68, and heard that report. And I stood up a different person. I was already a young mother. I was 24 years old. I had two little boys. I was expecting my third. And my entire life changed. I knew I wanted to meet those people. I met them through the Catholic Worker. And so the rest is history. It still is taking personal responsibility for trying to stop the violence that's being inflicted on other people. So that's what they were trying to do with the burning of the draft files, and joining a community, the Catholic Worker. So I joined actually in 1988, joined the Catholic Worker. So I've been down here at the Catholic Worker House in D.C. since 1993. So I've been part of Plowshares actions, five of them, one thing I want to invite people to consider is tax resistance. You know that Dorothy Day refused to pay federal taxes because of we were making us all complicit in the genocide. Right now, when we're paying taxes, we are complicit in the genocide in Gaza, the attacks on the people of all over, and now the war in Iran, the attacks in Venezuela and Cuba, and threatening Greenland and the whole world. That's what we're paying for, and that's what I'm inviting people to take whatever they think they owe to the federal government of the United States and walk it down to a public school or a health center or a library or something for life. Do not give your money to mass murderers. And that's what we're doing, paying federal taxes.
And that's the voice of our guest, Kathy Boylan. She is with the Dorothy Day Catholic Workers Organization, longtime organizer. What was your first action, Kathy? What was the first nonviolent action that you took place in?
Well, the first most costly one was pouring blood at the Pentagon. And I did that when I have five kids and they were young when I did that. And of course, you know, there was a family disagreement.
What year was that?
84.
1984. You got, so how did that go down? A bunch of you got together. Well, you took in pig's blood and you poured it all over.
No, our own blood. That's our own.
Oh,
blood.
Wow! And tell us about that.
I poured it on the pillars of the Pentagon. So that was very costly. I spent a month in prison, and our family was not, my husband did not approve of what I was doing. So it became costly in my family also. But I guess even before that, I was arrested trying to stop the Shoreham nuclear power plant. Which I was involved in that too, because my husband was a vice president of the Long Island Lighting Company building that reactor.
Wow.
So that was pretty costly. And not that I went to jail for that, but it was quite a stark division in our family life. Anyway, here I am. I'm still alive.
Yes, you are. And you're still fighting. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of our guest, Kathy Boylan. She works with the Dorothy Day Catholic Workers Organization. Well, you've seen a large swath of history. You've lived under many, many presidents at this point, as have many of us. What's your view of the current juncture and this current crew that's in the White House?
Well, actually, I'd like to say that all of the presidents are war criminals, mass murderers.
It's kind of in the job description, right?
There's none of them that, you know, Trump, Biden, you know, began the genocide and maintained it. And so was Kamala Harris. She was going to, you know, people say, oh, we should have voted for her. Oh, my gosh. She lost because of her her support for the genocide in Gaza. That's what I believe anyway. But none of them are good. And that's why tax resistance, if we'd stop paying them any money and give our money to life instead, we might have a better country.
And what do you think of this new pope? I mean, he's said some pretty strong words recently about, you know, warmongers having blood on their hands and that they can't or shouldn't, that, you know, that God doesn't listen when you invoke God to wage war.
Right. Yeah, the words have been very strong. I want to see action, though. He has to get out of the papal palace. And I've invited both popes. I started in 23 when, as Gaza was being slaughtered. I wanted Pope Francis and then Pope Leo to go to Gaza. Israel would be very hard pressed to say, no, the Pope cannot enter Gaza. No one can enter Gaza. You know, even the Catholic bishop in Jerusalem, he did get into Holy Family Church, but not an ongoing basis. The Pope could do that. And I compare what Pius XII should have gone to one of the concentration camps of Hitler. He should have cut a hole in the fence and allowed the people to leave, or he should have accepted the fate of the millions of people who were killed by Hitler and the Nazis. He didn't do that. Gaza is a concentration camp. The Pope should go to the concentration camp called Gaza. And I wish he would, but they don't. I've been writing, I demonstrate, I stand in front of the Vatican Embassy. I write almost, now it's you know, a couple of times a week. It was once a day, go to Gaza. Go to Iran. You know, take your wonderful words of solidarity with the victims, take it to the victims. Don't tell us. Go there and say it. Go to the suffering victims. It's ongoing in the victims in Gaza, Iran, everywhere that was described, Sudan, so many places. So the Pope should go. Get on, you know, go, not to visit, you know, countries that are not, they said that Francis was sick and he couldn't go, but he went to five countries that were at peace when, after they told us he was too sick to go.
Well, so. Kathy, I wonder, you know, we hear today the change of the name from Secretary of Defense to Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, says a lot in itself. And today he's invoking God and saying that God is on the side of the Trump administration. We've also seen many evangelists who are now, I forget her name, but President Trump has a spiritual advisor who's this woman who speaks in tongues, this evangelist woman who says that wherever she walks, that's where the Lord walks. And what do you think of these folks who invoke God in the name of, first of all, a cult of personality, and secondly, to wage war and to kill people?
Well, I that's blasphemy. There's a sin called blasphemy, and it's attributing to God all that it. God is love. John's gospel. God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God. There's no room for killing in love. So I'm sure they're doing it for, you know, I don't know that they're serious Christians at all. They're just using what they believe as it will help the cause for more killing. But God, the commandment is clear. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill. That's to everyone. So I don't know. I wish, I hope people don't pay any attention to them. But certainly if they are religious, they're committing the sin of blasphemy. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to your listeners. Thank you.
Our pleasure. Again, that's the voice of Kathy Boylan. She's with the Dorothy Day Catholic Workers Organization based in Washington, D.C. Kathy, it was a pleasure talking to you today here in Flashpoint.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you.
Well, now I'd like to introduce our next esteemed guest. Bruce Gagnon is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. He's a co-founder of the Global Network when it was created in 1992. Bruce and several of his cohort were recently arrested in a demonstration and protest at the Pentagon. Bruce, welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Good to be with you.
Give us a little bit of history of yourself, first of all, how you got involved in Catholic activism, how you this organization was founded. I know earlier I talked to you about the Berrigan brothers, and you were aware of them, and you'd actually met them and worked with them before.
Well, I'm not formally a Catholic worker, but I've been hanging out with them. Let's use that expression. For at least 40 years or more.
Catholic worker adjacent.
Yeah. So, but I grew up in a military family, an Air Force family. Graduated from high school in Wheatland, California, Beale Air Force Base, and joined the Air Force in 1971 during the Vietnam War. And after training, was sent to Travis Air Force Base in California. It was an airlift base for the war. When I was a young Republican in 1968 for Richard Nixon, at that time living in the panhandle of Florida, so conservative there, they call it Lower Alabama. And so when I joined the military, I was a hardliner, right-winger, supporting the war in Vietnam. And when I checked into the barracks at Travis Air Force Base, they put me in a room with one of the leading organizers in the GI resistance movement. So at night, there would be meetings in my room talking about the war, talking about racism in the military. When he was from Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, and he looked just like Joe Namath. That's all I can tell about him. But anyway, I'm sitting in the corner, and eventually my chair moved into the circle, and these guys changed my life. And I've been an organizer ever since. I worked for the United Farm Workers Union in Florida. Early on, they trained me as an organizer, organizing fruit pickers. And then I got into the peace movement in the early 1980s when Reagan was president, pushing Star Wars, which now has morphed into Golden Dome, you know, this new so-called impenetrable system over our heads. It's going to cost trillions of dollars. Great profits for the aerospace industry, even though the American Physical Society says it will never work. So anyway, I'm here now at the Catholic Worker House, and I was honored to be a part of that protest at the Pentagon last Friday, where 27 of us were arrested right at the very entrance, where people come out of the metro stop at the Pentagon. They're lining up to go through security. And there we were with banners and signs, singing religious songs. And it was a great, great day.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of my guest, Bruce Gagnon. He's a coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. He and several other people, sounds like a couple dozen actually, were arrested at the Pentagon for protesting. So you were merely there with signs and banners and singing, and you were arrested for that?
That's right. We were held, we were arrested by about 10 a.m., and they put us into this Pentagon facility where they train dogs, security dogs, and 27 of us with our cuffs on. I was released by around 2 o'clock. Others didn't get out till after 4 p.m. So it was a very slow process. The fingerprint, high-tech fingerprint machine wasn't taking our fingerprints properly. It took forever to do that. They had one computer for 27 people. They had 50 people guarding us, watching over us, many of them dressed out in the most elaborate riot control apparatuses you could ever imagine, as if we were some big threat. But they were the most disorganized bunch of people I've ever seen in all the years I've ever been arrested.
Well, there you go. Hegseth's Pentagon, of course. Well, you've clearly been at this a while. Let's talk a little bit about your sense of militarism in the country today, under this Trump administration, the second Trump administration. It seems like all the rules have been bent, all the rules have been broke. We find ourselves closer to a possible global confrontation than we ever have.
Well, I think it's what I call chaos theory. Trump is creating global chaos because they want to drive the global economy into the hole, into the a black pit, so that they, the Silicon Valley high-tech bros, they want to take control of the global economy. They have a lot of money. If everything crashes, they think they'll be able to take control of all the fossil fuels. It's all about war for Trump's favorite partners, which are the fossil fuel people. He's gotten rid of as much solar and wind and other alternative energy development as he can in order to make us totally reliant on fossil fuels. And so it's a war really to put the United States on top in control, not only Venezuela's oil, Iranian oil, anybody that's got oil, we're going to be in charge. So this is the plan. It's a very dangerous plan. I saw yesterday the GOP is announcing that they're going to have to cut health care programs in order to fund this war. I guess that means Medicare, Medicaid, various health care programs like that. I think they're going to be going after Social Security before long as well. So they've long planned to defund social progress, move the money into the Pentagon, and take control of the world for U.S. control and domination, because they see the rise of the global South. They see BRICS. They know that this is the last chance. This is the last moment where they might be able to, quote unquote, stop this. Hegseth is now talking about, forget this global South stuff. We're going to control the entire North and South American continent. We're going to be in charge of it from Greenland all the way down to the end, to the tip of South America. We're going to control everything. So this is their plan. In order to do so, again, they have to create chaos. But, you know, there's always an Achilles heel. So what's the Achilles heel in this case? Well, it is, it's money. And it's the reaction of the American people. As you cut healthcare, as you cut Social Security, as you cut education, you cut everything, you turn America into a failed state. The people are reacting. And we're on the verge of a civil war in this country. We've already seen them turn out ICE to go after the people. So, you know, it's crazy. But I think the American people really need to get on the alert. This thing is not going to go away by electing some Democrats. You know, we've got to talk about all these issues and connect the dots. It's all connected.
All right, well, we're going to leave it there. Again, that's the voice of my guest, Bruce Gagnon. He's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Bruce, it was a pleasure having you here today on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
Does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Let's be honest, there are plenty of subscriptions taking your money and giving you very little back. KPFA is not one of them. The station is here every day, free, bringing you independent news when it matters most. That only happens because listeners step up as monthly sustainers. A guardian of KPFA means your subscription keeps this station free for everyone, including people who cannot afford to give. Right now, one of the kindest things you can do is help somebody stay informed. Become a guardian at kpfa.org.
You can touch that dial if you miss being told what to think. This is 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online everywhere at kpfa.org.